It is time for another Techie Talk. State Representative Techie Chan of Quincy joins us for our weekly update. Hi, Techie.
Hey, good to see you, Joe. And we found the high definition function on Zoom today.
Yes, if people can see more of my wrinkles and gray hairs and more of your dining room, that's why.
I know, you can see the wonderful dish shelf on the other side, which normally is obstructed most days, unless you get the like pre-recording videos of me that I do off my phone in high definition, which is also pretty interesting through COVID, as I'm constantly adjusting my cell phone to try to line things up. But you know, the world we live in now.
Yeah, it's only taken us 2 years to figure it out. So, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising, right? We're finding new features every day. I'm just happy I'm not using the dog face feature or other types of Zoom-related graphics, which I understand is always fun, but not necessarily good for work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think the whole novelty of, you know, using Zoom is pretty much over.
I agree with that. You know, obviously the stock prices are reflecting Zoom's, you know, slow down. I mean, if you invested this in January 2020, obviously you've made it like a bandit. But as we more come to some in-person living with COVID as opposed to going to zero COVID tolerance, you know, people, you know, take the precautions and risk levels they're willing to do. And I remind folks, you know, folks that are still uncomfortable or immune compromised, or maybe taking care of people immune compromised, or work in a setting where you could expose some people that could still suffer severe illness, even though they're not die. I mean, nobody wants to be sick. So, you know, people should continue to wear a mask and I, you know, hope people continue to practice good hygiene. I mean, this, again, I said this in 2020, I'm shocked that people don't know what good hygiene is, which still frightens me today. But I mean, you know, people should practice, you know, good health safety still. But things are, you know, vastly better. But again, no one wants to get sick.
No, exactly. And it's good to point out, I think, that you can wear a mask if you want to. You know, there's nothing that says you can't.
That's absolutely correct. And you know, any establishment says you can't is kind of interesting, because now, you know, you're telling you can't keep yourself safe. And quite frankly, one of the most inintrusive ways to other people.
Right. It has no impact on, you know, people around you. Exactly. It's just now, especially with the high quality masks, it's strictly for your own protection.
Precisely. So, you know, things are getting better, but as I tell folks, the death count is still higher than I think, you know, any of us would like to see, staying in the double digits daily. And like we're seeing around the world, you know, it's predominantly the unvaccinated who are taking the highest severity of illness, particularly ICU, and it is disproportionately higher on the death count, sadly, on the unvaccinated folks on a global level. So as the wave is finished in Massachusetts and the Northeast Corridor, you know, places in Asia is now facing their massive surge. Some places like China and Hong Kong and Taiwan and Macau have adopted zero tolerance. Countries like, you know, Korea and Thailand and Philippines have adjusted to can we live with this and manage the surges? And we'll see how they handle it. Given the fact there's obviously plenty of lessons learned from the United States of what you should and shouldn't do, like we should be learning from, you know, South Africa and Europe and things you should and shouldn't do as we move through. But Omicron B2 is much more infectious than the original Omicron or Delta or Alpha or the original. I was watching today, the Omicron, original Omicron is about 70 times more infectious than Delta. And B2 is 1.5 more infectious than Omicron, which means that it's 1.5 times 70 from Delta, which is, you know, easy math of 105 times more infectious than or is it more than that? 1.5. So yeah, it's actually more than that. It's 150 times more infectious. So, you know, than the original Delta. So I can't do math, as you can all tell, but you guys can get the gist of the problem.
Given you know, the current lull, Tacky, what do you think the state should be doing to kind of, I guess, brace itself for any kind of upcoming surge or new pandemic?
Well, unfortunately, the problem with Omicron and other diseases is that you don't know till it shows up. So as we've said over and over again in the news, you watch it in the news, you say it all the time, it's all data driven. every scientist, every doctor, all government officials are watching data. And once the surge occurs, when a high infection rate due to testing, you know, that test can't find out, you know, you are able to start to see a rise in numbers, which then you have to respond to. The problem of Omicron and potentially other variants, if it spreads fast enough, by the time we respond, it's almost too late. And that's the inherent problem. And one of the things people don't realize is Omicron B2 is now being referred as a stealth COVID or stealth Omicron, because while your rapid home test will likely catch it, the rapid home tests are very good, and especially do it twice, once every 72 hours to do a second confirmation. Scientists on the PCR tests and other more tests to find the genetics of it are having more trouble identifying Omicron B2. And why is that important to us? It's important to understand what the spread rate is going to look like from a scientific standpoint. Now, definitely your rapid test, your walk-in test, that's going to be probably commonplace by summertime at CVS's and others, will tell you if you're sick or not. That isn't the concern. Scientists and doctors want to know what variant or version we're dealing with, so we have an idea what the spread rate, the severity of illness, and things like that. However, you won't know until it comes up. And this is why this is such an uncertain situation. And also, a lot of, you know, I'm sorry, look, it creates aggravation for all of us. I'm aggravated too, right? I mean, mask on, mask off, you know, go in, go out. We all share the same exhaustion of this. But there's no way for us to predict until it shows up.
Yeah, although the wastewater data is a pretty good indicator.
Yeah, MWRA represents more than 40%-ish of communities, or maybe a third of the population. Is it 40%? Is like 53? I can't remember the number. As you guys have discovered time, my numbers ain't good, but I mean, it represents well into, you know, a million five of the population.
Right. So
it's a large sampling of 7 million people. And but still, I mean, you're going to do monitoring constantly, but it's still testing as the, you know, way to go. So obviously, I suspect, you know, if people have, you know, any basic symptoms of COVID, high recommendations, rapid testing, particularly if you've been outdoor exposed to people, if you've been in limited human contact and you got the sniffles, the odds are good that you just had a cold.
Right. Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the spending bill, Jackie, that was approved this week?
Sure. We did a $1.6 billion deficiency budget. In the old days, we called them deficiency budgets. We call them supplemental budgets now. Short of it is it's strictly a bills. We're paying bills. And it's probably the largest one I've seen a governor file. But we're living in unusual times. Housing assistance, LIHEAP, which is low-income field assistance program, which obviously right now with the war in Ukraine has become even more critical, and other types of COVID-related and, you know, snow removal and things like that. So it's not an exciting spending piece. There is no pork in it, essentially, so to speak. And also we're anticipating a large number of refunds. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do with these supplemental budgets bake in the fact that the state is not going to get certain amounts of revenue. Thankfully, FY22 has been extraordinarily strong by anybody's expectations, which means we won't take as much a hit on refunds and credits. And we also are exempting from state taxes the emergency pay that we approved last winter, $500 in emergency pay. So we're not going to be collecting taxes on that, given the strong revenue numbers there. But again, it's been very unpredictable. Inflation will have a definite impact on the economy, even though unemployment rate, you know, is below 4% or floating right around there, depending on what month we're in. And there are jobs being added, but wages and inflations don't seem to match up still. And, you know, and with the war in Ukraine and obviously energy prices, but not just energy prices. I mean, a lot of other things too. I mean, that's the one that dominates the news, but I mean, supply chain issues and wheat. I mean, Russia and Ukraine, especially Ukraine, you know, contribute to 25% of the wheat production on the planetary level. Hmm. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things that that is impacted by this war that we'll be feeling at home. More so. And, you know, people in the stock markets, people trading commodities are trying to anticipate now, unlike dealing with COVID, they have to show up. They're on the anticipation level. So a lot of the price fluctuation on fuel and energy and wheat and other types of commodities are under a lot of price structure speculation, because the people who trade in these markets are trying to anticipate future price.
Yeah. I know there was a failed attempt to suspend the state's gas tax. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know. People don't like paying our debts and getting erosion bridges fixed. I mean, you know, I understand that other states looking to suspend the gas tax. Gas tax in Massachusetts about 24 cents. You know, it's not going to, if gas prices go up to like $5, you won't even notice the 24 cents is not there to begin with. But, you know, our transportation bond funding, and we're going to have another transportation bond soon to match the, do our match against the federal infrastructure bill. You know, it's funded by things like the gas tax. Wall Street likes to see some type of revenue stream. And part of that also goes into the, which actually all goes into the, what do you call it, the road and bridge or infrastructure trust fund. That's where the gas tax one goes. And then, you know, some of that's used to pay roads and bridges. Some of it's secure against, you know, our bonds. So, you know, there was an argument on the floor, well, Wall Street will care and help us out. No, they won't. I never seen a Wall Street banker say to a state or a city, hey, you can't pay your bills or you can't demonstrate your revenue stream anymore. Well, we won't affect your bond rating. We'll give you a better interest. I mean, what kind of world do these folks live in? I'm listening to the debate yesterday, like, oh, they'll help us out. I'm like, this is coming from the Republican Party. I'm like, no, I just don't see Wall Street bankers going, huh, you cut off a revenue stream. We're going to give you a deal. I mean, these are like the arguments that just doesn't make common sense that we're dealing with these days. And I kind of chuckle because it's like, what? So, I mean, that's the short of it. If you don't want to stuff, you want all your projects suspended or delayed on road and bridge projects. You don't want us to be able to provide our match against the federal infrastructure bill. You know, it's going to be difficult. And then the federal infrastructure bill is $9.5-ish billion. $9.5-ish billion over the course of a decade. We got to match about 20-25%, depending on which project we're talking about, which the state's going to put up. And that will actually help municipalities too on the local level if they don't have to put up their share of the money. So, you know, we're not talking about small amount of money here that we're going to need a good help from Wall Street on interest rates. And it's up to us to try to create the best scenario possible. And by the way, if we don't pay it now, you're going to pay for it later. So if we go like a year of a gas tax, well, what do you think is going to happen, folks? You want to take a big, I'm going to have to vote for another spike in gas tax. You think I really want to do that in a year's time because we delayed a year. Now we've got to make up a year's worth of money. Yeah, that's a wonderful idea from my standpoint. Yeah, like I want to do that kind of thing. No, of course not.
So that, I mean, there has been discussion about looking into possible price gouging. Do you think that might be something that has some legs to it?
Not unlikely. The way the pricing works with gas stations, it's a fixed rate per gallon. So generally it's anywhere between 3 and 7, or depends where you are in rent. I tell you a lot, it's rent driven. So obviously if you're in a high rent area, you might be close to 7 or more cents. If you're, you know, in a more reasonable area, you can close to 5, but price competition with a lot of gas stations in the region creates a scenario where we have price structures fairly similar to each other, maybe within 1 or 2 cents. I don't know people realize that over the years, gas price structures have really kind of been competitive in a geographic zone on being as close to each other as possible. And so gas stations are not gouging you. They're not. They're not a percentage of the cut of the action. It's a fixed cent on each gallon. So the question has become a price gouging on the providers, you know, the wholesalers or the manufacturers. And again, we go back to the speculative market because while they themselves, you know, provide the fuel and refine the fuel, I mean, those costs are predictable, but you know, they can't predict what the commodity market's going to look like. So even though you see the barrel oil go up to $1.30, you know, it was like $1.11 the other day, you know, it's going to fluctuate a lot because people are trying to buy in anticipation for future price for resale, right? Buy low, sell high. And that's not an easy calculation. And they don't buy like $130, you know, a barrel. They buy, you know, 200 million barrels at a time, mm-hmm. these commodity markets. So it can create massive shifts in the price structure. So now on the local level, people are trying to anticipate what those price structure will look like because they have to pay that gas like now. Gas stations do not get a IOU. It's COD, cash on delivery.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, Secretary of State argued that the gas that was purchased, you know, before the price hikes should have been kept at that price level. But these, as you say, these stations are saying, well, in the future, we're going to have to pay this much. So we need to charge this much to make up that difference.
Yeah, I hope people appreciate this with gas stations. I mean, if you're bought, let's use the example, you bought your gasoline for a totality of $100 for the sake of easy math, and you're looking at price fluctuations, and you're not sure what the next shipment's going to come in, what price. Right. They suddenly charge you $140 as opposed to $100, but you're only making, you know, let's say you're doing 5 cents, so you're making essentially $5. Mm-hmm. So you get $105, but you have to pay $140 cash up front. You got a problem here. So right. Obviously the gas stations are trying to also anticipate what the fuel cost is. We're talking to the wholesaler, which is also talking to the manufacturer, you know, and all the delivery service and getting here. For example, you know, when they truck your gas to the gas station, it's in a truck. The truck uses gas. The gas is paying the higher price of gas to get you the gas, right? You know, a diesel, whether it be diesel mm-hmm. or unleaded. So, you know, those guys are really in a tough spot where they're going to have to adjust the price structure and trim, you know, basically trim the size of the profits to, you know, keep the lights on while trying to anticipate what the next shipment's going to cost them. And then when they get the bill, you hope it matches what they're thinking it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, the people that are pumping your gas, the people that are fixing your cars at these locally owned service stations are not making huge profits. They're small, you know, independently owned stations that are just trying to get by.
Yes, they're basically franchises. Small independent businesses are franchises. Again, that's why I've always been supportive of places like Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's and such, because they're actual franchises. The small mm-hmm. business owner has a franchise agreement. They run a small business. They run to the ground. It's not McDonald's' problem in the end. They just get the cut of the action. As opposed to the guys at Starbucks, which is a multinational corporation, giant octopus, which owns every single store, and all the profits go back to Seattle. Mm-hmm. The manager of that store only makes a salary, and you're never going to get rich on it. It's all run by Seattle. So, you know, I always get a little frustrated by people that rally against, you know, franchise businesses, because it's like, it's easy, it's good, it's easy politics, it's easy media. But I mean, he really like took a good look at it. You should be protesting people like Starbucks.
Yeah, and that, many of those franchises give back to their local communities, you know, in terms of supporting local sports teams or civic organizations or what have you. They're the first ones to step up to the plate.
And also subject to individual price structures. While they're like a McDonald's franchise, you know, does have to require, you know, they require you use McDonald's. I mean, you know, have to go to Notches on your products, right? Yep. And you have to, you know, stay to certain menu items. At the same time, though, I mean, they have to pick up those costs. It's not like McDonald's gives them, you know, those cups and those wrappers and that food. You still have to pay for it. There's that bulk shipping benefit. However, you know, there's not like they gain bulk electrical benefit costs, right? Yeah. You know, so, you know, unlike Starbucks, where it's all shipped in from central, for lack of term, through their own supply chain system. I mean, you know, it's again, the corporate entity controls the price structure in its entirety. So the markup is going to be very different because, you know, different types of shareholder situation.
Mm-hmm. I know, Tech, there's been talk too of the state looking to divest whatever assets it has in Russian-owned businesses. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I get nervous about the word divestment. And the reason is because in the state's case is the pension fund. And the pension fund is in pretty healthy shape. And it's actually pretty conservative overall. I mean, I've talked to Perrick and Prim and those guys in the past. And, you know, they try to balance some you know, social justice-ish type stuff against the pensioners' interests because, you know, you don't have any money to pay the pensioners. We got a problem. And at the same time, you know, try to grow the fund in a you know, reasonable manner. So one of the interesting things about the investment of Russian businesses, and again, I like to stress these are businesses that are Russian, state-owned or Russian origin businesses, not Russians in the United States running a business, right. Or, you know, Russians in Europe. For example, Stoli Vodka is not made in Russia. It's not incorporated in Russia. It's not really a Russian business. I believe it's a Latvian business. Mm. It's actually EU, it's a NATO country. But people like looking at Stoli Vodka, like this is a problem. So Stoli actually had changed the brand of their product to not use the word vodka in it anymore. Even though technically speaking, that is what the alcohol is. But back to the issue of divestment. The challenge is that you can't just unload stock if you got nowhere to unload the stock to.
Right. The Russian stock market's closed.
Yeah, they opened and they closed. They're going to open and close. And foreign transactions are very difficult because we kind of like cut them off from the planet. So, I mean, if people not notice, we have pretty much cut the financial system off, including central banks, and all our government state-owned assets are frozen by EU countries and other allies of the United States, to just freeze over their assets. So for us to divest, those Russian portfolios from Russian stock markets requires us to sell them in the Russian stock market, which is nowhere to sell. On the flip side, though, they're not exactly making any dividends. So, and thankfully the pension fund is big and diversified. They can withstand, different hits. As the pension fund learned in 2003 and 2008, those two big recessions, the stock market took a huge smack. Mm-hmm. And the pension fund had learned from those two huge recessions how to not to put the eggs in one basket, so to speak, and diversify. And also Bernie Madoff, people remember him. I mean, he ruined some pension funds around the country, too, where people put in like 10% plus of their pension fund in there. And when that Ponzi scheme collapsed, he took a massive hit. Yeah. We are very conservative and very diversified in Massachusetts. So the Russian market stocks, are taking a dive. But there's no way to get rid of it. I mean, you got to go back to the market it came from. And I got the SEC problem. Is the SEC going to let us get rid of stuff? Mm. Or we're going to continue to freeze? And, as I say, this one act of war has permanently changed a relationship between Russia and the rest of the world. And I don't see this going back to the way it was anytime soon. This is a damage to the Russian economy for going to be a decade, I suspect, if this continues, or just continuous damage.
Yeah.
What happens, recovery is going to be very challenging.
As I understand it, the state only has a very, very small, like a 0.2% of its pension funds invested in Russian businesses, about $140 million. So it's very negligible.
Yeah. The pension fund is, I think, close to $80 billion now.
Something like that. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's negligible in terms of size of the fund. And like I said, those are now frozen assets. So it's not like the Russians are making any money or losing money. I mean, everything's trapped in stasis, which for this purpose is losing money. You can't get at your assets, you're losing money.
Right. What do you think about the whole situation in Ukraine, Tacky? I mean, just from a personal perspective.
Well, it's absolutely horrifying. Obviously, we've seen tragedies in Sudan. We've seen Syria, Somalia. There's a war in Ethiopia right now, too. I mean, it's not like there's no global conflicts. It's just that, we don't always pay attention to stuff, what's going on around us. And of course, Afghanistan had consumed our minds for a long time, the United States as well as Iraq. Mm. But I mean, this is the largest single two-country invasion we've seen really since World War II. Mm. I mean, it's 44 million people, 150 million people in Russia. It's the second biggest army in the world by raw numbers and equipment. So it's a major power. We've not seen a major power do an invasion in the European theater in like ever since World War II. I mean, this Cold War stuff, I mean, playing in other people's elections, CIA, cloak and dagger type things. But I mean, in terms of like straight up, like we're going to march in and blow you up, it's frightening. And people saw that, they showed a nuclear power plant. I mean, this is not good, folks.
Right.
So why does it matter to the United States? I mean, this isn't like a war in Ethiopia, which doesn't have the same impact on us, even though it's also a huge human tragedy. You should look it up if you have not. Obviously, I talk about wheat. We talk about energy. Ukraine is a major fossil fuel country. It is a developing nation in the sense that they do have hospitals, they have universities. You've seen on the news, students from all over the world do go to school in Ukraine. It's actually part of the economy. Big tourist country as well. They had to remake themselves, but also the access to the Black Sea. I mean, to get Russia to get any warm water ports, because the only other ports in the North Sea, Finland, Norway, all the cold spots, you need to get to the Mediterranean. And the Turks, actually Turkey, controls the strait from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. The Black Sea is big. I mean, it's a big, big sea. Mm. So if they control basically all of the ports in Ukraine plus their sections, they control the entire access point for trade to come in and out of that region. The human tragedy is incredible. I mean, it was pointed out in the Syrian conflict, set 1 million people into the EU. Obviously, a lot of countries like Poland has taken somewhat of a U.S. stance of anti-immigration in some ways, a very Trumpian sort of, I don't want to use that word exactly, but, you know, for the sake of easy context for everyone listening, it's a little more complex. But I mean, you know, Poland had one point, you know, put troops on the border, or Belarus, because Belarus's solution to torturing Poland was throw all the Syrian refugees into Poland. And that didn't go well. Now you got Ukrainians coming over, you know, 2 million Ukrainians escaping any way they can to Moldova, Romania, you know, and Poland in particular. And the Polish basically opened the border, so it's just let everybody through.
Yeah.
And 2 million people against 44 men escaping and counting is frightening. And there's immense bravery of people who love their country. One of the best interviews was a woman who says, you know, from Ukraine, says, our government's corrupt. It's you know, not in good shape. You know, we're unhappy of everything. But, you know, essentially, she said, our problem to fix is Ukrainians. It's not the Russians' problem. So you're invading your country, claiming to be liberators. Liberators of what? It's a democracy. I mean, it's like saying that, you know, we should be invading the United States because we had an insurrection on January 6th
right.
of last year. Well,
right.
That is
so Canada should come down and liberate us, right? Yeah,
exactly. This is our problem, not your problem. You know, this is why we don't get involved in civil wars in other countries. This is a domestic problem. We can sanction, we can make statements, we can do all kinds of things, but we're not going to go marching troops in your civil war in the 21st century because it's a domestic issue. This is not a domestic issue. This is a second biggest military power invading a significantly smaller country, causing a humanitarian crisis, destroying hospitals, destroying schools, you know, killing children. You know, I projected, my personal projection was maybe up to 15,000 civilian casualties this week. I might be conservative on this number with the way they're just trying to shell out. And this is very much a early 20th century tactic of war. The way you get your population to submit is just bomb the living life out of all of them and make the population miserable and to hope the population will overthrow the government.
Right. Yeah.
That's what's going on here. They're putting fear in the people to say, oh my God, these Russians are going to destroy us all. Let's overthrow the government and bring the Russians in. I mean, this is an unusual tactic, folks.
It's a terror tactic, right? Yeah.
This was done in the 20th century. This is not new. It's just they're operating in that method. And, you know, obviously Ukrainian people, you've seen, has really done a great job controlling the messaging on a global level. And you know, again, the people in Ukraine believe this is their problem. It's not your problem to solve, and we're going to defend our country and then win, and then we'll solve our government problems domestic.
I interviewed an IT consultant in Ukraine earlier this week, and he was very blunt. He said, I did not vote for the current Ukrainian president, Zelensky, but I fully support him and support my country. That's his feeling.
Yeah, I was watching a bit of European news, and one of Putin's calculations of invading Ukraine was the low approval rating of both the parliament and the president, and the legislative executive bodies were both very, very low poll ratings. I mean, worst poll ratings in the United States. I mean, they were looking like 80% unapproval. So part of the thinking of Putin was that, well, you know, they're clearly doesn't like their government. If I come in and liberate them, so to speak, you know, the people will love me. And obviously that was not true.
Yeah, he really miscalculated that for sure. They've had 30 years of independence, and I think they like the taste of it.
And they've been in war with Russia sort of for 8 years, ever since the invasion of the Donbass and the Donbek, can't pronounce anything, and the Crimea regions.
Yep.
They've been fighting on the skirmishes of that border war essentially for 8 years. They've had 8 years to ramp up the military. They're a professional military. And I think, you know, I think people don't quite understand exactly how well-equipped and how closely aligned to the EU, NATO, and US regarding intelligence data. You know, they were ready for a fight, and they've proven it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think he'll stop in Ukraine?
No.
Really?
No. I mean, you know, the reality is that you talk about rebuilding the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union. But it's also, you know, this is a guy from the Cold War. I mean, I was talking about Biden being, you know, Vietnam, Cold War, War II kind of guy. Yeah. He's 76-year-old. You know, Putin is not a young person either. He was around when the Berlin Wall fell. He was actually in East Germany when that occurred. And, you know, he was able to figure out how to make money in the post-Soviet Union and work his way to power to what you see today. And, you know, it's clear that he's still operating under a 20th century tactics in Ukraine and, you know, other places. But he's too deep in.
Hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, people, I think people understand this. If you look weak, particularly at that type of situation where you're not really a democratic system, someone's going to replace you.
Hmm. Okay.
It doesn't matter how much money you have. It won't matter because you might be, you know, in a bad, bad place.
Mm-hmm.
They try to get rid of you. And of course, the Russians control the state media. They pretty mm-hmm. much made it possible for third-party media, outside country media to broadcast or provide information. And they're going out for the internet very much like how China does in terms of censoring information to the public. You know, 60% of the population plus, you know, believes this is a just and right military operation to secure Russia.
Yeah.
Not an invasion. And of course, you guys heard about this theory they've put out there into the world and in local, their own local media that the US was doing chemical weapon plants inside Kiev. No, of course not, right? But it's almost like an excuse for them to use chemical weapons or biological weapons because they claim it exists in the country. They're kind of like making up their own excuses.
And they can go unchecked because, as you say, there's a blackout in independent news.
Well, the Ukrainian forces, you know, are going to get armed. I mean, you know, any former Soviet bloc country like, you know, Poland, Latvia, you know, all the Baltic states, you know, you think they're going to put up with this? I mean, no, they've already lived under oppressive rule. They don't want to do this a second time.
Right.
Enjoyed the EU. They've enjoyed NATO. They enjoyed democratic, enjoyed freedom of travel inside Europe. They enjoyed, you know, a lot of a middle class life that we enjoy here a very long time in this country. They've had this middle class lifestyle much shorter time than we have
mm-hmm.
people. And I don't see people want to give that up. So, you know, the Russians have actually one big mathematical problem, which is again, it's the 44 man, well, 42 man and dropping a bit. But the only solution to deal with a population side is just wholesale slaughter.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Ukrainian men are required to stay in the country between 18 and 60, although suspect some little younger and some little older staying behind, you know, picking up a weapon or creating barriers or providing medical assistance or food or whatever skills they have to support fellow countrymen in the government. It doesn't matter if you can't fire a weapon. You could, you know, if you have medical skills, you're going to go out there. If you know how to cook, you're going to go out there. If you know how to scavenge, you're going to go out there. If you're an iron welder, you're going to start making barriers. I mean, people who do whatever it takes. And this is a problem for Putin because it's not just people with guns, but they have a whole, you know, supply chain ability in Ukraine to try to do whatever it takes to, you know, make it miserable for the Russian military.
Yeah.
And Putin's already hired 1,000 mercenaries. And he's claiming he's using no conscripts, which is a sell to the Russian people, but the Russian army is almost 2/3 conscript.
Conscript? What is that, Jackie?
Mandatory military service.
Okay.
So this is something that U.S. really has never done ever, is that in many, many countries, folks, between the age of 18 and 20, before you can go to college, you have to do military service. Some countries let you defer, like Singapore. You can go to college and come back and do your 2 years of military service. So, you know, places like Taiwan, Korea, Ukraine, a lot of countries actually require you to do basically 14 to 2 years-ish of military service. Some of, you know, you have to know how, you know, shoot a weapon, you know how to be part of national defense.
Mm.
You have to be able to, you know, operate military systems at some level or be able to rapidly train. We have the National Guard here, but the National Guard's voluntary.
Mm-hmm. So is the military. Yeah.
Yeah, that's mandatory. A lot of places in the world have conscripts, and I don't think people understand here how fortunate they are. If when I was in very nice, you know, many, like 3 decades ago now, I met folks that was able to avoid conscript for their time in government, but fully aware once they go back to country of origin, they're going to have to do the military time.
We did have the draft, of course, years ago, but that's been gone for a long time.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same thing.
Right.
Well, draft during war means that, you know, we're calling up reservists, essentially reservists, to have rapid training and throw them on the front lines quickly. Conscription means that, you know, you got to be military ready when they call on you because you receive your training at, you know, in your late teens, early 20s.
Hmm.
So not to say that everybody in Ukraine is an expert marksman, but they will have, you know, some basic understanding of their firearms.
Sure. Interesting. Do you think this whole situation is going to delay the recovery from the pandemic here?
Yes, economically, it will. I mean, obviously, we felt, I said earlier about inflation, obviously, there's a lot of components. There's not just energy, there's a whole lot of other components of inflation. But also, it may cause a problem with spread. I mean, Ukraine is not exactly a country that got a lot of vaccine. It's about five, not a lot of people have confidence. Russia's COVID vaccination rate is not all that great. So, one of the things, that worried me right off the bat, and obviously, the priority is to escape the war. I mean, that's number one priority. But obviously, with Omicron infection, given its spread, obviously you're going to have a opportunity for more spread going around, and potentially maybe another mutation if there isn't higher vaccination rates. And this is kind of the tragedy of a lot of places where they're in a civil war, like Burma, now called Myanmar, is amidst the civil war, very low vaccination rate, very high COVID, complete total infrastructure from the military junta screwing the place up. Ukraine, we've seen the footage, total, devastation in major cities. Yeah, that's kind of one of the unspoken thing about this news cycle. The COVID spread through Europe, and these refugees are going to be coming in to a lot of European countries and also the United States. And we're going to have to, like we did with the Afghans and the Haitians, we're going to have to manage COVID vaccination rates and identification as they come in. I mean, who knows that, how are we going to have that vaccination cards? I mean, the hospital's been blown up, the physicians somewhere.
I understand the supplemental budget that was just approved included money to help Ukrainian refugees here in Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yeah, we put aside some money in anticipation of, we revisit the issues, get to the budget, we revisit the issue again, as the year go along, and do most likely next year as we look at the influx of Afghan refugees. We're well over 2,000 and probably more. And now we're looking at influx of Ukrainian refugees as well. As you guys all see, I mean, there's a lot of solidarity, not just among European nations and others, but I mean, Americans as a whole, just no matter where you're from or where your family's from, that this war is, the tragedy is unjustifiable and, a humanitarian crisis. I mean, 2 million peoples in under 2 weeks, no one's seen that kind of migration ever. Even World War II, I mean, there was migration because they were trying to escape the Germans, just bulldozing through Eastern Europe. But 2 million people in 2 weeks. Yeah, it's unfathomable. It's unfathomable. And we're so far away from the United States, and we're just getting news coverage and watching social media. And but I mean, imagine being on the ground. In places like Poland and Moldova. Moldova is not a rich country, by the way. They don't have a lot of resources. And the neighbor next door is Romania. So, I mean, people going through Moldova to get to Romania. And again, not an EU country and all that, but not wealthy. I mean, people keep forgetting exactly how better positioned the United States is. We're at $23 trillion GDP. Russia's a $1.4 trillion GDP and shrinking fast. Well, you're looking at, Romania, which is doesn't even blip in the top 50.
Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous strain on those countries for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes people forget, how good is it really here? And just the raw scale of just not even comparable size governments, militaries, but also economies to be able to provide support and assistance.
Curious to see if this situation brings more bipartisanship to our nation's capital.
No, these no.
Tacky.
Yes,
Always glass half empty.
very much so. I mean, they got midterm elections going up, frankly, and frankly, people really are just domestic minded in terms of a lot of their politics. They don't really think globally. We just don't. I mean, most people don't even know, like I said, the civil war in Myanmar, the war in Ethiopia. People don't know. They don't care because it doesn't put right in front of them in their news or the social media feed saying this is now something happening. It's always going to be their domestic issues and also their value issues. Have we seen that's actually driving a lot where people try to impose their values on other folks because they're afraid of things that aren't different. That's a big difference, okay. So, I think a lot of this rhetoric on you know, these so-called wedge or single issues are in these midterm elections in both primaries and finals will be coming up. You know, people are not electing your state officials or your federal officials to discuss international policy.
Honestly,
we should know something about international policy, about global economy. But no, that's not going to happen. The same partisan rhetoric in elections and in Washington is how they get their fundraising. And they don't like this type of fundraising where you just bash people to make money for yourself and to appease a small number of super donors that can raise you a ton of money if you follow their small group of folks trying to influence the rest of us. And, and just pushing their domestic agenda. In a tough way is, again, I mean, it's not like Ukrainians are voting for us. We have to have a local population vote for us, and it's responding to your population. And I talked about this last time, and guys like Putin and Xi in China are relying on our impact on our wallets to try to influence guys like me, but more importantly, guys like Steve Lynch and Liz Warren and Ed Markey, because you're hurting at home. Well, let's change our international policy to be capitulating to other big economies and big militaries because your wallet is hurting at home. So let's give the Chinese the run of anything they want, or give the Russians Ukraine. What do I care? You're hurting me in my pocket. That's what they're relying on. I promise you, they know. Some reason people don't think we live in this isolated world where people don't know what's going on here. I mean, we have an open free media. Everything you post on social media, trust me, they can find out overseas what you're saying, and they can gauge what the mood of the public is here. And they feel that if your pocketbook is hurt bad enough, you're going to call the president, your congressman, your senator and say, I'm hurting. Who cares what happens to these people? Let's move on. And that's what they're hoping will happen.
Yeah. Can we switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about, is there a bill, Tacky, about right to life or right to die in Massachusetts that's being debated?
Yeah, it's not new. Assisted suicide is not a new issue. It's been around for well past a decade. There was actually the ballot question, remember, about 8 years ago or so now. There was a ballot question. It was defeated narrowly by a very small margin. I think it was under 2% margin. And the issue keeps resurfacing. But, I always tell folks a lot of our decision-making when it's done by ballot question is, I know it's an old ballot question now, but I mean, gives us a statewide polling without actually doing polling, right? I mean, your polling means nothing until you actually have the votes come in.
Right.
Well, this is going to be a continual conversation. It's been going on well into a decade, and it's going to continue again.
Okay. Do you have a particular feeling about it either way?
Yeah, I've always had a lot of hesitation in this because modern medicine is pretty incredible about its ability to, save people from the brink. And also, we also have other ways to make people much more comfortable. Medical marijuana comes to mind right away. I have a friend of mine that was dying of prostate cancer, had a very good quality of life right to the very end. And it wasn't to the last moments quality of life declined. And largely thanks to medical marijuana in that instance, he was going to go. But, modern medicine has given you higher quality of life longer to enjoy with your loved ones and your loved ones to enjoy with you. So, I mean, right now the proposal, I believe, is that you have 6 months less to live. You have to have a couple of verified doctors. You have to have, demonstrate your sound mind and conscience. You have to demonstrate a lot of things. But as we've seen, just a little thing like medical marijuana, maybe you should try something, as kind of give you a better quality of life to the end. So, like I said, I've always had a bit of hesitation just because every time this comes up, something in our world changes rapidly. We talked about COVID a lot last year. We didn't know what we were doing. A lot of people were dying because the medical community had no idea what they were dealing with. Right. Suddenly we have life-saving drugs, or at least drugs that have potential to try to make you recover from getting off a ventilator.
Yeah, the new federal policy, I guess, is test and then treat right at that same moment. If you're detected to be positive, to start the treatment right away.
Yeah, and that's within the past, not even 2 years at this point. Right. I mean, 2 years today that we had the state of emergency.
Right.
But I mean, in terms of, rapid treatment, I mean, if you, apply to end of life options, people, on ventilators are conscious and aware of what's going on and decide they want to put a plug, but the medicine's available in the next 3 days.
Yeah. All right.
That's an extreme example, mind you. I am making an extreme example.
Yeah, but I understand the point. Technologies, medical technologies are advancing very, very rapidly. So you don't know. You don't know what the future holds.
Yeah, and that makes it a little more difficult to understand because the people that get left behind saying, what if, is your family members, not you. But I do understand that people don't want to die in suffering. I get it. I
Yeah.
get that.
Yeah.
But then people are going to say, what if, is not the, not you who's gone. It's going to be people who have been left behind.
Any pandemic era state regulations advancing or continuing through this bill that was just passed, Jackie?
Well, we expand outdoor, so-called outdoor dining and takeout cocktails and beer and wine until April 1st of 2023.
Okay.
I hope to be with you on April 1st, 2023. This is an election cycle.
Speaking of not knowing what the future, yeah.
Yeah. This is a message I'm going to stop beating the drum on. I did this with Mark Crosby last week. You know, a takeout dining does not really end on April 1st, 2023. You've always had takeout dining ability on the local level. Municipalities, mm-hmm. license board, and building inspectors, or inspectional services, depending what we're talking about, as well as the health boards, all have the ability to do outdoor dining. That is not the problem. So the news media has really mischaracterized this as like outdoor dining never existed before until we created this, you know, this law that suspended all the laws. So you have no due process. You can't complain about it. You have no public hearing. You have nothing, folks. That's essentially what occurred in the pandemic. And of course, given the uncertainty and we're trying to keep the industry alive any way possible, you know, we create a mechanism for municipalities to just, who cares about due process and the public? We're just going to do whatever to save these businesses. Right. And I think the public was tolerating it to a point. And then the other argument was regarding the ABCC review process regarding expansion alcohol licensing in contiguous spaces, meaning that you want to have alcohol in additional spaces than the original license allows, which in this case, outdoor dining. So, well, we get that too, in suspending that and only really providing just some notice to know what's going on. And of course, there was a policy regarding originally just beer and wine. And the policy of beer and wine originally during pandemic, the height of pandemic, was that, you know, beer goes bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, you know, restaurant buys the beer, the wholesaler, you buy from the wholesaler, you can't use it, goes back to wholesale, wholesale has to destroy it, costs them money. They can't get the money back from the manufacturer. They hope to get money back from manufacturer loses money. You guys get the whole idea of how it works. So the idea is that, you know, the faster they can get rid of this beer through takeout process, you know, actually helps everybody at some level. It saves us destroying, you know, quite frankly, it's alcohol. You have to destroy it properly. And, you know, try to, you know, at least get rid of inventory as fast as possible. Obviously, we're at a different time now. It's a policy that should be revisited and take a look at again, whether it makes sense. And of course, you know, takeout alcohol includes things like DoorDash, Uber, and delivery services. I have a lot of issues with that, largely the fact that people aren't checking IDs, they're dropping and running. I mean, during a pandemic, a heavy pandemic, people are exactly like knocking your door, checking your ID, like, here you go, and just dash. Or just leave your front door, hit the doorbell and run if it's good weather, right? So, and also because large volume, they had to do a lot of orders. So, you know, this was more time. The legislative session ends on July 31st, provided that we don't have another crisis, that it creates another situation where there is no end of session. Hopefully, there'll be no crisis to do that. And gives me some breathing space because I'm the guy dealing with alcohol and outdoor dining.
Right.
Chair of the committee to work with my co-chair and discussing how to manage this. And I will have a plan by session's end. But legislative changes in the off season between July and end of July or August 1st to the new session in January. You know, as informal sessions, any one person can stop a bill. And if I come up with legislative fixes, it will probably have to happen sometime in 2023.
Okay. Something to look forward to. What about the provision for remote public hearings? When does that expire?
I believe that's the end of fiscal year, this June.
Okay.
At this stage, as we talked about, you know, the mask mandates have ended in Boston. Vaccine card mandates have ended in Boston. Most of us have figured out how to do social distancing, if that's what your desire is wearing masks and hopefully with vaccinations. I mean, I believe we're almost 79% two-dose vaccination in
Massachusetts. Yep.
We're at 95%, which for the purpose of statistics, closest we're going to get. The basic statistics, statistically speaking, once hit 95%, a one dose vaccination is they basically stop counting at this point.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, ideally we want to be close to 90% two dose vaccination because Omicron is that much more infectious.
Yep.
It still can make you sick. It's still be asymptomatic transmitter, potentially. But the alternative is being really sick in a ventilation in ICU. All municipalities should have some ideas of what they should be going forward regarding in-person. I understand town meetings may be hard if you live in a town, you have open town meeting, everyone just kind of shows up in a big room and cram together like sardines.
Right.
And also state boards. An interesting feedback, particularly from state boards, is the fact that since people who sit on boards all over from over the state, they're looking at more hybrid models going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to have to drive from Amherst to Boston if you don't have to, right?
Yeah, or Wilmington, you know, like a 4-hour drive, you do like a 2-hour hearing once a week. So, I mean, that is something that may be coming permanent. We'll be hearing from administration and other executive branch offices, you know, how they would like to do some combination. At the legislative level, you know, you guys all know, particularly with my state representative, Tacky Chan, Facebook page, you know, I just spent 2 years trying to figure out how to make what I'm doing right now, talking to you, work in a public hearing format. This was a lot of trial and error, a lot of technology problems to make it work. And we've received feedback from my colleagues who are from much further distance from Boston and how it's been easier for their constituents to convey their message to us through this format. Sure. But again, also a lot of management issues. It's a little bit trickier to be in person. Difficult to try to move people out of order. People don't show up. It becomes a real problem in this format. It's harder to figure out if I can just move along. You're having technical difficulties. The logistics are very different. Right. But, you know, I suspect that we will have, moving into 2023, I mean, I'm going to skip that public hearings in this format for remainder 2022, but moving 2023, provided, you know, I'm still a chair, who knows. I'm going to need to talk to whomever my co-chair is and start and with staff and start to rethink about some type of hybrid model. The state technology is not well designed for hybrid. It's Microsoft Teams. They can't run more than three things on Microsoft Teams at one time right now, which is a big problem because there's 28 joint committees.
Wow.
32, but 28 actually have a lot of bills. The other four don't have as many. But I mean, it's you know, 20, you got to potentially 21 hearings in 1 week. You know, some committees do two hearings in 1 week and then you have a formal session. We don't have the personnel technology wise, which is why this is run on my office staff and myself. And I've done, if you watch the video, sometimes you see me like completely like blank out because we have a tech support problem. My chair, a co-chair, Sue Moran, is actually running the hearing. And we're trying to, and one of the people tried to testify had like all kinds of problems. So I'm on, you know, the chat box on my phone, trying to figure out how come this person can't get on. And it's like the other chair becomes tech support. I'm trying to pay attention to hearing. We're trying to solve a problem at the same time.
Yeah.
So you see when I'm not chairing every so often, there's like that look on my face, like, oh no. And then, you know, one of the reps get dropped off and, you know, it's different. So it's almost like the other chair is this, you know, is the tech support. On the committee. So when I'm on, Sue Moran's, you know, dealing with somebody's logistical issues when I'm chairing the hearing virtually. So, I think people don't, you know, this is why we have this show. It gives you an idea of what goes on behind the scenes that you don't realize that, you know, I actually, myself, as well as staff and my co-chairs and their staff, you know, are trying to run things as smooth as possible. And things happen that we can't anticipate and we have to deal. So, you know, learn a lot of lessons in 2023. We'll reevaluate how we're going to do hearings, but remainder 2022, you know, I have a public hearing coming up Monday, the 14th, under retail alcohol license expansion ballot question.
Oh, okay.
So that's 1 p.m. on Monday on State Representative Tacky Chan's Facebook. If you want to come take a look, if you miss it, it's going to be a recording provided on the MALegislature.gov, mm-hmm. MALegislature.gov website under the public hearing section, and they can watch the recording there. We'll keep improvising, figuring it out no matter what happens.
Okay.
I personally think we've been fairly successful in trying to, you know, not torture people too badly, so to speak, in video.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the accessibility and convenience factor, you can't argue with. It's immeasurable, really, especially certainly in the middle of a blizzard too. You know, I mean, it definitely has advantages that that it's never going to go away.
No, as long as we can maintain an interconnection, or if you lose your internet wire, you can always, if your phone has some roaming ability, you got 5G, you won't get, you know, it won't be the same as exactly the same as wire, but I mean, you it's really good.
Yeah, and there's still, you know, the old type telephone technology, you can still listen and talk too without being seen. Yeah,
you can zoom in on the telephone if you lose internet connection. So, there are ways to make it happen. Sometimes you see me on the screen, or we're having some technical problems. Maybe you won't see me on the screen. I have to dial in, but somehow we'll be there.
That's right.
So, you know, I don't think lessons are done yet, as we keep moving forward. You know, we'll learn how to do things. We'll keep learning how to do things.
Seems like a good point to ask you to give out your information, contact information, Tacky.
Sure, 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. The State House is open, as you are aware of. We're taking people of no mask requirement, no vaccination card requirement. However, internal offices can do what they need to do. Mm-hmm. Staff and I are discussing about continuation of contact tracing. God forbid someone gets sick and you don't know about it. Right. So we're discussing that matter still, as well as continuation of doing that and mask requirements and things like that internally. So we're running mostly a skeleton staff. But right now, we've always had a fairly smooth running. I know it's not perfect, fairly smooth running virtual. So we're doing actually a hybrid right now. So 617-722-2014, give us a ring. Obviously, you can email me at tacky.chan, T-A-C-K-E-Y.C-H-N at mahouse.gov. I'll get your email. You all hear I prioritize, and sometimes your stuff ends up in junk mail. So I do check that too now, trying to find you in my junk mail. Gotta love Microsoft Outlook. They just...
it always thinks it knows what's best for us. Yeah.
Yeah, I have the same problems the rest of you guys have, okay? I mean, if you do a new Microsoft Outlook, you know what I'm talking about. And then, obviously, I talk about State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. There's a public hearing coming up. You guys want to see me again? I'm there. And then, tackychan.org. Again, it's a reference site more than anything else for phone numbers and things like that that are important. And of course, being here viewing QATV, you can watch on my past shows and see how I have new information from old information, because the old information is no good anymore.
That's why we do it every week, because things change. Really appreciate it, Tacky. Great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Jonas. See you in a week's time.
All right. Take care.